greet you again. We come now to our Bible study, and we hope that you have had a good time of testimony and prayer and sharing together and fellowship. This should be Easter Sunday, if I figured correctly, and I hope that it's been a good day for you and that the Lord has blessed you. We're going to begin our study tonight in the book of Exodus. This is an interesting book, probably one of the best-known books in the Old Testament. We finished Genesis last week, and most of the people know the basic stories of Genesis, and most of the people know the basic Exodus story of the nation of Israel from the land of Egypt. Now, this book deals with something more than just the Exodus, but we'll find that out as we go along in weeks to come. The book of Exodus is attributed to Moses, and the date of the book is something that's a little bit in question. Scholars seem to argue about that a little bit, and I don't think it's too terribly important. Some might put a great deal of importance on it, but I don't think we need to go to that deep a study on it right now. For now, we'll take it as being approximately 1300 or thereabouts B.C., and that it was written by Moses, and it's an honest, straightforward historical record. Now, I put it that way because there was a time sometime back when a number of scholars apparently felt that Moses didn't write it, that a number of different writings were put together to create the book, but the continuity of it and the line that runs through it and is being discovered in the archaeological work that's been done over the last 50 or 100 years, and more and more evidence indicates it to be a first-hand history tree, probably, most likely, by Moses. It's attributed to Moses, and let's assume that it is for our study. Now, we begin in chapter 1, verse 1, and I don't know that I'm going to try to read it all. I'll just kind of sum it up as we go along. We're going to move rapidly through the first few verses. It gives there a list of the children of Israel that came out of Egypt, and the fact that there were 70 souls descended, in effect, from Jacob that were in the land of Egypt at the beginning of this history of the book of Exodus. They came out and shared place with Joseph. Joseph, you remember, was the one who provided a good deal of, I'll say, watch care over his father's children. And then we're told in verse 6 that Joseph died, and we studied that last week, and verse 6 adds a little bit more. And all that generation, in other words, all of the direct, immediate descendants of Jacob died. And then verse 7 starts another paragraph, another thought. And the children of Israel were fruitful, and increased abundantly, and multiplied, and waxed exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. Now, what's it saying? No birth control. The Israelites multiplied greatly. Verse 8 says, now they got a new king in Egypt, and he didn't know Joseph. Now, this is moving ahead from the start of the growth of the nation of Israel in the land of Egypt to approximately 400 years in the future. Just spanned in a paragraph. And we come to a Pharaoh who didn't care anything about Joseph. He didn't feel he owed anything to him. You know, after 400 years, this little thing like a seven-year famine is going to melt into the pages of history. It's a thing that's so far in the past that it has no effect on the here and now, and doesn't mean a thing. No matter what Joseph and his wisdom might have provided for the Egyptian, it's long gone. But, you know, Really, in this country today, we look back to 200 years ago, and we say what the founding fathers of this country did doesn't mean anything now. It's time for change, and the old ways are no good, and the sacrifices of the revolutionaries in 1776, well, what does it mean today? We need a new revolution. You know, all of this, it fades into insignificance. The Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, in the eyes of many today in this country, have lost their meaning. The sacrifices of men who knew what it was to live under tyranny, under restraint, who had their freedoms, greatly limited. Their sacrifices and their wisdom, it means little or nothing today. People today, if you want one man's opinion, I think that we're just a shadow away from someone coming on the scene and saying, lay it all down, we'll set it up by machine, and everybody just lean back in his easy chair and collect their welfare check and their unemployment check. Nobody has to work except a few nuts. You know, I wonder if we haven't already entered that. The welfare load in this country, and I'm not getting into politics, I'm only talking about the shadow of things that we can see that are coming. We know that there's going to be a man who's going to accede to power by deceit, by promising people what they think they want, and by giving it to them. This just kind of makes me think of it. Here's a man 400 years later that didn't know Joseph, didn't know his history, didn't have any sense of values. And so, what does he say? Now, before I go into this, maybe we need to examine the fact that God had a hand in this. You know, God couldn't leave the nation of Israel in the land of Egypt forever. He had to move them out someday, and he had to set up a set of circumstances. He had to permit a set of circumstances to come into play. And maybe, from our viewpoint, these circumstances weren't too pleasant, weren't too beneficial in the immediate present as they were occurring. But in the long run, they were for the benefit and the good of the nation of Israel, to get them off of the and running, let's put it that way. All right. Now he says unto the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. He wasn't so dumb, was he? They had multiplied and in numbers apparently had exceeded the population of the native-born, you can't even call them native-born, the Egyptians, all right? They were a foreign people in a foreign land, and they had multiplied to an extent that they passed in numbers of the people that belonged in the land. You know, they didn't belong where they were. Verse 10, come on, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply and it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us and so get them up out of the land. What'd they say? Well, he says, you know, he was one of these guys apparently that feared the worst. No matter what happened, it was going to be for the worst, and he couldn't see any good in anything. He says, if we have a war, these people may join with our enemies, and that's going to be pretty rough. We can't have it. All right. So, what's he do? Verse 11. Put them under bondage, put taskmasters over them, made slaves out of them, put them to work. Now, I don't know that this is the act that made slaves out of the Israelites. I think it was kind of a psychological thing here that did it. They knew they didn't belong in the land. They knew that the land of promise was theirs. They knew that they were there by, what's the word that I can use? Indulgence. That they could have been booted out at any time. And you know that after they get out in the desert, there's all that cry for the leeks and the onions and the and the meats of Egypt, and they were a little afraid of their security and stepping out in faith. I wonder if there's a little of that in some of us as Christians, myself included. We're afraid to take out and go where God wants us and do what He wants us to do. If that's in any of us, myself included, maybe we ought to pray about it. In any case, their tasks were increased and there was more compulsion put upon them, so that by this time and through these acts, they had a whip cracking over their heads. And verse 14 says that they made their lives bitter with hard bondage and mortar and brick and all manner of service in the field. All their service wherein they were made to serve was with rigor. In other words, they had to work and work hard. And then verse 15, the king of Egypt spake unto the Hebrew midwives, of which the name of one was Shipharah, and the name of the other was Pua. I can't even pronounce them, whatever they are. And he said, when you do the office of a midwife to the Hebrew women, and see them upon the stools, if it be a son, then ye shall kill him, and if it be a daughter, then ye shall live. But the midwives feared God, and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the men children alive. And the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said unto them, why have you done this thing? You saved the male children alive. And the midwives, they made a little excuse. You know, Hebrew women, they're not like the Egyptian women. The Egyptian women are delicate and dainty, and these are strong women, and they deliver the children before we arrive, and it's too late for us to do anything. We only kind of clean up and comfort them and bathe them and so forth, and, you know, we can't get away with this. So God dealt well with the midwives, and people continued to multiply and waxed very mighty, and it came to pass that the midwives feared God, and in effect, this, what it means here is that he blessed them. And then Pharaoh just kind of made it plain. He issued a law, and it sounds very cruel, and it was. He just made it. He said, every son that is born of the Israelites, doesn't say that here, but that's what it's meant, he'll be cast into the river, and every daughter will save alive. That's, I guess, the first recorded instance historically of mandatory birth control, and I would say it was pretty extreme, because by doing away with the males, why, one of two things would have to happen. In a generation or two, there could be no fathers unless the Israelites' women married Egyptian men, and then there would be an intermixing of the races and a blending that probably would have been accepted to Pharaoh. They would have been considered Egyptians. And I think the underlying thing that we need to recognize here, whether we like it or not, the Israelites knew who they were, and they maintained a segregation from the Egyptians. I strongly suspect, while there's very little evidence of it, that's plain, they totally submitted themselves to marriage within their own race. And this is what God expected of them. They did not mix with the Egyptians. I think if they had mixed with the Egyptians, they wouldn't have had any of this political turmoil that they were going through. Now, you can judge the right or wrong of it, but it was God's intent to keep them pure at this stage. I don't know what effect that has on things today, but for these people, they were to be kept separate. And they apparently, for the first 400 years or so, managed to do that. And Pharaoh is kind of trying to handle that. If we get rid of all the male children in a little while, there won't be any Israelites as such, because they're all in a generation or two going to have to be half Egyptian. And that makes a problem, doesn't it? All right, now chapter 2, we get into the birth of Moses. And there went a man of the house of Levi and took to wife a daughter of Levi, And the woman conceived and bare a son, and when she saw him, that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months. In other words, she just kept him out of sight for 3 months. And then, you know, she couldn't get away with it forever. Now, you know, I think that the evidence is that a lot of mothers managed to get away with it. I don't know how, but, you know, it wasn't a bunch of women that 40 years or so later went marching out of Egypt. It was a mixed multitude, and there was a generation that followed up. There were men that conceived and whose wives bore children, and there was a generation that followed 40 years after that in the wilderness that went into the promised land. So some of the male children must have been kept alive along with Moses. But the thing we're interested here is that Moses' mother figured out a particular way of doing it. She made him a little raft of bulrushes. She covered it with pitch, and I would assume that she put some grass in the bottom of it, and maybe a blanket or two, and covered the child in it, and put it in the backwater of the river there, where it could be seen from shore, and then wanted to see what would happen. And we're told in verse 4 that Moses' sister stood afar off and to see what would happen. And again, here's where God steps in. Verse 5, the daughter of Pharaoh, she came down to take her morning bath in the river, and her handmaidens, they're walking along the river there, and they see this little raft floating among the reeds, and the baby is brought out. And, you know, verse 6, it says, "Behold, the baby wept." Can you resist a crying child? A little baby? Is there anyone in the group tonight who, if there were a baby laying by itself and crying and appeared to be in pain or discomfort, could resist reaching down and doing something about it if nobody else was nearby to do it? You'd pick it up and hold it and love it. And once you'd done, well, it's what happened here to Pharaoh's daughter. It's just nature, really. She had compassion on him. And she knew what she was doing. She said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. And by this time, Moses' sister is nearby. And she says to Pharaoh's daughter, you want me to go find a nurse of the Hebrew women so that she can nurse a child for you? And Pharaoh's daughter, you know, she kind of had the idea planted in her mind, I think, by this young lady. You have to give Moses' sister some credit. She said, you're going to let that child die, is what she's saying. You want me to go find somebody to nurse the child? Once Pharaoh's daughter had picked up that child and heard it cry, she assumed responsibility for it. A lot of psychology in this, when you think about it. And she took the obligation. There's no way she could duck out of it, and she didn't really want to. And so she says to Moses' sister, go ahead. And so we see in verse 8 what happened. Moses' mother. And Pharaoh's daughter gives her Moses back to Moses' mother, and she gets paid for caring for her own child. That's kind of an unusual blessing in a sense, I guess. Verse 10 says the child grew, and I would assume that when the boy was of an age to be weaned and growing a little bit, probably walking, she brought him into Pharaoh's daughter, and he was literally adopted as the daughter, or the son of Pharaoh's daughter, therefore Pharaoh's grandson. And Moses was actually named by Pharaoh's daughter. And Moses, well, let's see, my margin says that the, let's see if I can find it here, the name Moses means that is drawn out. And she said, and in verse 10 says, she named him Moses and said, because I drew him out of the water. Funny way of naming people, wasn't it? But that's the way Moses got his name. And if you keep it in mind, in the review of Moses' life, as we go through it, you'll find he's drawn out in many ways. He's drawn out by God. He's drawn out by Pharaoh and the test. He's drawn out in the testing in the desert. Moses is drawn out in a lot of ways when you think about it. But that's a name that's given to him by Pharaoh's daughter. Now, verse 11, another paragraph. And a period of time goes by. I would suspect that in verse 11, Moses is probably 21, 22 years of age. I think if we did a little work here, as we go along, we could figure out just how old Moses might have been. But in any case, he's a young man, and he knew his heritage. So it says that he went out unto his brethren and looked on their burdens, and he spied an Egyptian smiting a Hebrew, one of his brethren. And what's he do? Well, he looked to the left, he looked to the right, he looked forward, he looked backward, he looked up and he looked down, he looked all around. He didn't see anyone. That doesn't mean he wasn't seen, but he didn't see anybody. So he killed an Egyptian, and he buried him there in the sand. And the next day he went out, and he sees two Hebrew gentlemen fighting together, and, oh, Moses, righteous Moses, he said to him that did wrong, "What are you hitting your brother there for?" And the man that was being accused said, "Who made you a prince and a judge over us? What do you intend to do, kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" Oh, boy. Moses feared and said, "Surely this thing is known." And verse 15, apparently it was. Now when Pharaoh heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian and sat down by a well. Now the priests of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water and filled a trough to water their father's flock. And the shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. Now what's it say? Well, here's a little country preacher who has seven daughters, and he's got a little flock. And he sends them out to water this little flock, and they come to the well, they draw water, and they fill troughs in attempt to water their father's flock. But the shepherds of the area came by, and they drove the sheep away, drove the girls away, and Moses, stepping in again, interfering, going to get him in some more trouble maybe. But Moses, he stood up, must have been hiding behind a rock or something, because you get the distinct impression he wasn't seen when all this started. He wasn't seen by the seven girls. He wasn't seen by the shepherds who came up. But when the problem starts, he makes himself known, and he helps the young ladies, and he waters their flock. And when the girls get back to their father, typical dad. He says, "Now look, girls, how'd you get done so quick? You sure you water the flock like they ought to? You shouldn't be home so soon." And he's a little worried that maybe his flock didn't get taken care of. And the girls, they said, "Well, there was an Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds, and he did all the hard work for us. You know, big strong man here. He drew the water enough for us and watered the flocks." Now, the reputation, the manner of clothing, the regal appearance of Moses marked him as being an Egyptian, not a Hebrew. What's this priest do? Well, he said unto his daughters, "Where is he? Why have you left him? I mean, you're not very hospitable. Now, why don't you invite him home to have a little bread?" And Moses was content to dwell with the man, and he gave Moses Zipporah, his daughter. So, there, you see, that's what I meant. When Moses was going to get in trouble, stuck his nose in there and ended up with a wife, didn't he? Well, maybe that wasn't so bad. If she was as good as some wives, why, Moses made a real good bargain. And verse 22 says, "She bore him a son, and he called his name Gershom." That means a stranger here. For he said, "I have been a stranger in a strange land." And then, verse 23, it says, "It came to pass in the process of time that the king of Egypt died, and the children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage, and they cried, and the cry came up unto God by reason of the bondage, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and with Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God had respect unto them. What's it say? Well, it says things got so bad that circumstances drew the people of Israel to their knees. Brought them to an attitude of prayer. You know, I wonder if that isn't part of what's happening in this country today, that God's letting things get so bad. You know, something has to give. I've told you recently that, you know, maybe in more times than once, that I have a deep sense of something about to happen. I'm not a prophet. I don't pretend to be a prophet. But I look at the scriptures, and it seems that everything points to a time, a great event to happen. Probably the rapture of the church very soon. If not that, it's obvious from the workings of God and the justice of God that, and the holiness of God, that he must do something about conditions around us. And is he permitting circumstances to build up to such an extent that, one, his church will come back to him with a repentant attitude, an attitude to seek the face of God and the favor of God, to come to the foot of the cross and submit ourselves totally and completely to the will of God. You know, we talk about this so often, but I don't think that any of us are really committed to the will of God like we ought to be. If we were, God would be doing more. God uses willing instruments, and he stops when there are no willing instruments. And then he begins to set up circumstances that make us willing. Now, he's going to start with the church first, it would appear, and then through the ministry of the church and the witness of the church, if it works, the world, the unsaved individuals that are still here. Now, I'm getting tired in a certain sense. I'm not complaining. But it seems like such a hopeless task. How long has it been since we've had people come into our church and the preaching has reached their hearts and they've committed themselves to Christ? We see very little fruit here. Sure, we have a beautiful, loving fellowship one for another. We do care for each other. We have Christian love. And among ourselves, the fellowship is good. But do we have anything that is attracting the world around us to the house of God? Are we living in such a way that people want what we have? Do they even recognize that we have anything? I don't know. But here, we're looking at a situation that got so bad that the people had to cry out to God, complain to God. Listen, we say we shouldn't always be coming to God and complaining and asking, but sometimes God puts us in a position there isn't anything else to do to cry out to him and ask for mercy, to ask relief from our circumstances. We've had it so good that we don't know what it is to have it bad. And I hope we don't have to find out. I don't want to find out what it is to have it bad. I'm sorry, but I like the good. And I want to continue in the good things of God. But I'll accept the bad if it brings the rest of us, to all of us, to the throne of God and causes us to submit ourselves to him. Well, it's just about time to quit. I hope that we've given you something to think about. It looks like we'll have two more weeks of this, and then we'll be with you on Sunday evening services, the Lord willing. Maybe one more week, if the Lord is willing. We'll wait and see what happens. You be in prayer. Continue to pray for us. And pray one for another. Pray for next Sunday morning services, that the Lord will bless, have his way. Pray that God will bring someone new in, and that the word will reach them. I'm hoping that by the time you sit and listen to this on an Easter Sunday evening, if it is Easter Sunday, the Bible courses begin to move and bear fruit. We've done much to see about getting it out. By now, you'll have heard it in the morning services. Be in prayer and ask God to bless our ministry. Put on our hearts a burden for souls that we can see the need to do what needs to be done. Now, I know they sound like words, and that's all they are. I'm going to ask one of the gentlemen to come up and close the service tonight in prayer. And may the Lord bless you and keep you this week until we can see you again. God bless you.